He glanced down. I think it is a primitive thorn. It's hard to tell. And then, it was my father's. There was a chiming noise then, to signal that soon enough the flea market would close. Would you like food? I asked. He looked at me warily. My treat, I said. No obligations. There's a Denny's over the road. Or there's the bar. He thought for a moment. Denny's will be fine, he said. I will meet you over there. I waited at Denny's. After half an hour, I no longer expected him to come, but he surprised me, and he arrived 50 minutes after I got there, carrying a brown leather bag tied to his wrist with a long piece of twine. I imagined it had to contain money, for it hung as if empty, and it could not have held his stock. Soon enough, he was eating his way through a plate piled with pancakes, and eventually, over coffee, he began to talk. The sun began to go out a little after midday. A flicker, first, and then a rapid darkening that began on one side of the sun and then crept across its crimson face until the sun went black, like a coal knocked from a fire, and night returned to the world. Balthazar the Tardy hurried down from the hill, leaving his nets in the trees uninspected and unemptied. He uttered no words, conserving his breath, moving as fast as befitted his remarkable bulk, until he reached the bottom of the hill and the front door of his one-room cottage. "Oaf! It is time!" he called. Then he knelt and lit a fish-oil lamp, which sputtered and stank and burned with a fitful orange flame. The door of the cottage opened, and Balthazar's son emerged. The son was a little taller than his father, and much thinner, and was beardless. The youth had been named after his grandfather, and while his grandfather had lived, the boy had been known as Farfel the Younger. Now he was referred to, even to his face, as Farfel the Unfortunate. If he brought home a laying fowl, it would cease to give eggs. If he took an axe to a tree, it would fall in a place that would cause it the greatest inconvenience and the least possible good. If he found a trove of ancient treasure, half buried in a locked box at the edge of a field, the key to the box would break off as he turned it, leaving only a faint echo of song on the air, as if of a distant choir, and the box would dissolve to sand. Young women, upon whom he fastened his affections, would fall in love with other men, or be transformed into grues, or carried off by Diadans. It was the way of things. "Sun's gone out," said Balthazar the Tardy to his son. Farfel said, "So this is it, then. This is the end." It was chillier, now the sun had gone out. Balthazar said only, "It soon will be. We have only a handful of minutes left. It is well that I have made provision for this day." He held the fish-oil lamp up high and walked back into the cottage. Farfel followed his father into the tiny dwelling, which consisted of one large room and, at the far end of the dwelling, a locked door. It was to this door that Balthazar walked. He put down the lamp in front of it, took a key from around his neck, and unlocked the door. Farfel's mouth fell open. He said only, "The colors." Then, "I dare not go through."
"Idiot boy," said his father, "go through and tread carefully as you do."
And then, when Farfel made no move to walk, his father pushed him through the door and closed it behind them. Farfel stood there, blinking at the unaccustomed light.
"As you apprehend," said his father, resting his hands on his capacious stomach and surveying the room they found themselves in. "This room does not exist temporally in the world you know. It exists, instead, over 1,000,000 years before our time, in the days of the last Remoran Empire, a period marked by the excellence of its lute music, its fine cuisine, and also the beauty and compliance of its slave class."
Farfel rubbed his eyes, and then looked at the wooden casement standing in the middle of the room, a casement through which they had just walked, as if it were a door. "I begin to perceive," he said, "why it is that you were so often unavailable, for it seems to me that I have seen you walk through that door into this room many times and never wondered about it, merely resigned myself to the time that would pass until you returned." Balthazar the Tardy began then to remove his clothes of dark sacking until he was naked, a fat man with a long white beard and cropped white hair, and then to cover himself with brightly coloured silken robes. "The sun!" exclaimed Farfel, peering out of the room's small window. "Look at it! It is the orange-red of a fresh-stirred fire. Feel the heat it gives!" And then he said, "Father, why has it never occurred to me to ask you why you spent so much time in the second room of our one-room cottage, nor to remark upon the existence of such a room, even to myself?" Balthazar twisted the last of the fastenings, covering his remarkable stomach with a silken covering that crawled with embroideries of elegant monsters. "That might," he admitted, "have been due in part to M. Puser's invocation of incuriosity." He produced a small black box from around his neck, windowed and barred like a tiny room, barely large enough to hold a beetle. "This, when properly primed and invoked, keeps us from being remarked upon. Just as you were not able to wonder at my comings and goings, so neither do the folk in this time and place marvel at me, nor at anything I do that is in any wise contrary to the mores and customs of the 18th and last greater Remoran Empire."
"Astonishing," said Farfel.
"It matters not that the sun has gone out, that in a matter of hours, or at most weeks, all life on earth will be dead, for here and at this time I am Balthazar the Canny, merchant to the skyships, dealer in antiquities, magical objects and marvels, and here you, my son, will stay. You will be, to all who wonder about your provenance, simply and purely, my servant."
"Your servant?" said Farfel the unfortunate. "Why can I not be your son?"
"For various reasons," stated his father, "too trivial and minor even to warrant discussion at this time."
He hung the black box from a nail in the corner of the room. Farfel thought he saw a leg or head, as if of some beetle-like creature waving at him from inside the little box, but he did not pause to inspect it.
"Also because I have a number of sons in this time that I have fathered upon my concubines, and they might not be pleased to learn of another. Although, given the disparity in the dates of your birth, it would be over 1,000,000 years before you could inherit any wealth."
"There is wealth?" asked Farfel, looking at the room he was in with fresh eyes.
He had spent his life in a one-roomed cottage at the end of time, at the bottom of a small hill, surviving on the food his father could net in the air, usually only seabirds or flying lizards, although on occasion other things had been caught in the nets, creatures who claimed to be angels, or great self-important cockroach-like things with high metal crowns, or huge bronze-coloured jellies. They would be taken from the netting and then either thrown back into the air or eaten or traded with the few folk that passed that way. His father smirked and stroked his impressive white beard like a man petting an animal.
"Wealth indeed," he said. "There is much call in these times for pebbles and small rocks from the end of the earth. There are spells, cantrips, and magical instruments for which they are almost irreplaceable, and I deal in such things."
Farfel the unfortunate nodded.
"And if I do not wish to be a servant," he said, "but simply request to be returned to where we came from through that casement, why, what then?"
Balthazar the Tardy said only,
"I have little patience for such questions. The sun has gone out. In hours, perhaps minutes,
the world will have ended. Perhaps the universe also has ended. Think no more on these matters. Instead, I shall procure a locking spell creature for the casement down at the ship market, and while I go to do that, you can order and polish all the objects you can see in this cabinet, taking care not to put your fingers directly upon the green flute, for it will give you music, but replace contentment in your soul with an insatiable longing. Nor get the onyx bogadil wet.
He patted his son's hand affectionately, a glorious, resplendent creature in his many-colored silks.
I have spared you from death, my boy, he said. I have brought you back in time to a new life. What should it matter that in this life you are not son but servant? Life is life, and it is infinitely better than the alternative, or so we presume, for nobody returns to dispute it. Such is my motto.
So saying, he fumbled beneath the casement and produced a grey rag, which he handed to Farfel.
Here, to work. Do a good job, and I shall show you by how much the sumptuous feasts of antiquity are an improvement over smoked seabird and pickled ossica root. Do not, under any circumstances or provocation, move the casement. Its position is precisely calibrated. Move it, and it could open to anywhere.
He covered the casement with a piece of woven cloth, which made it appear less remarkable that a large wooden casement was standing unsupported in the center of a room. Balthazar the Tardy left that room through a door that Farfel had not previously observed. Bolts were slammed closed. Farfel picked up his rag and began, wanly, to dust and to polish. After several hours, he observed a light coming through the casement, so brightly as to penetrate the cloth covering. But it soon faded once more. Farfel was introduced to the household of Balthazar the Canny as a new servant. He observed Balthazar's 5 sons and his 7 concubines, although he was not permitted to speak to them, was introduced to the housecarl who held the keys, and to the maidmen who hurried and scurried thence and hither at the housecarl's command, and than whom there was nothing lower in that place, save for Farfel himself. The maidmen resented Farfel with his pale skin, for he was the only one, apart from their master, permitted in the Sanctum Sanctorum, Master Balthazar's Room of Wonders, a place to which Master Balthazar had hitherto only repaired alone. And so the days went by, and the weeks, and Farfel ceased to marvel at the bright orange-red sun, so huge and remarkable, or at the colours of the daytime sky, predominantly salmon and mauve, or at the ships that would arrive in the ship market from distant worlds, bearing their cargo of wonders. Farfel was miserable, even when surrounded by marvels, even in a forgotten age, even in a world filled with miracles. He said as much to Balthazar the next time the merchant came in the door to the sanctum. This is unfair.
Unfair?
That I clean and polish the wonders and precious things while you and your other sons attend feasts and parties and banquets and meet people and otherwise, and altogether enjoy living here at the dawn of time, Balthazar said.
The youngest son may not always enjoy the privileges of his elder brothers, and they are all older than you.
The red-haired one is but 15, the dark-skinned one is 14, the twins are no more than 12, while I am a man of 17 years.
They are older than you by more than 1,000,000 years, said his father. I will hear no more of this nonsense.
Farfel the unfortunate bit his lower lip to keep from replying. It was at that moment that there was a commotion in the courtyard, as if a great door had been broken open and the cries of animals and housebirds arose. Farfel ran to the tiny window and looked out. "There are men," he said. "I can see the light glinting on their weapons." His father seemed unsurprised.
"Of course," he said. "Now I have a task for you, Farfel. Due to some erroneous optimism on my part, we are almost out of the stones upon which my wealth is founded, and I have the indignity of discovering myself to be overcommitted at present. And thus it is necessary for you and I to return to our old home and gather what we can. It will be safer if there are two of us, and time is of the essence." "I will help you," said Farfel, "if you will agree to treat me better in the future." From the courtyard there came a cry.
"Balthazar, wretch, cheat, liar, where are my 30 stones?
The voice was deep and penetrating.
"I shall treat you much better in the future," said his father. "I swear it."
He walked to the casement, pulled off the cloth. There was no light to be seen through it, nothing inside the wooden casing, but a deep and formless blackness.
"Perhaps the world has entirely ended," said Farfel, "and now there is nothing but nothing."
"Only a handful of seconds have passed there since we came through it," his father told him. "That is the nature of time. It flows faster when it is younger, and the course is narrower. At the end of all things, time has spread and slowed, like oil spilled on a still pond."
Then he removed the sluggish spell creature he had placed on the casement as a lock, and he pushed against the inner casing, which opened slowly. A chill wind came through it, which made Farfel shiver. "You send us to our deaths, father," he said.
"We all go to our deaths," said his father, "and yet here you are, 1,000,000 years before your birth, still alive. Truly we are all composed of miracles. Now, son, here is a bag which, as you will soon discover, has been imbued with swan's imbuement of remarkable capacity, and will hold all that you place inside it, regardless of weight or mass or volume. When we get there, you must take as many stones as you can and place them in the bag. I myself will run up the hill to the nets and check them for treasures, or for things that would be regarded as treasures if I were to bring them back to the now and the here."
"Do I go first?"
asked Farfel, clutching the bag.
"Of course."
"It's so cold."
In reply, his father prodded him in the back with a hard finger. Farfel clambered, grumbling, through the casement, and his father followed.
"This is too bad," said Farfel.
They walked out of the cottage at the end of time, and Farfel bent to pick up pebbles. He placed the first in the bag, where it glinted greenly. He picked up another. The sky was dark, but it seemed as if something filled the sky, something without shape. There was a flash of something not unlike lightning, and in it he could see his father hauling in nets from the trees at the top of the hill. A crackling. The nets flamed and were gone. Balthazar ran down the hill gracelessly and breathlessly. He pointed at the sky.
"It is nothing," he said. "Nothing has swallowed the hilltop. Nothing has taken over."
There was a powerful wind then, and Farfel watched his father crackle, and then raise into the air, and then vanish. He backed away from the nothing, a darkness within the darkness, with tiny lightnings playing at its edges, and then he turned and ran into the house, to the door, into the second room. But he did not go through into the second room. He stood there in the doorway, and then turned back to the dying earth. Farfel the unfortunate watched as the nothing took the outer walls and the distant hills and the skies, and then he watched, unblinking, as nothing swallowed the cold sun, watched until there was nothing left but a dark formlessness that pulled at him, as if restless to be done with it all. Only then did Farfel walk into the inner room in the cottage, into his father's inner sanctum, 1,000,000 years before. A bang on the outer door.
"Balthazar?"
It was the voice from the courtyard.
"I gave you the day you begged for, wretch. Now give me my 30 stones.
Give me my stones, or I shall be as good as my word. Your sons will be taken off-world to labour in the delium mines of Telb, and the women shall be set to work as musicians in the pleasure palace of Luthius Lynn, where they will have the honour of making sweet music while I, Luthius Lynn, dance and sing and make passionate and athletic love to my catamites. I shall not waste breath in describing the fate I would have in store for your servants. Your spell of hiding is futile, for see, I have found this room with relative ease. Now give me my 30 stones before I open the door and render down your obese frame for cooking fat and throw your bones to the dogs and the Deodands.
Farfel trembled with fear. Time, he thought. I need time. He made his voice as deep as he could, and he called out,
"One moment, Luthius Lynn. I am engaged in a complex magical operation to purge your stones of their negative energies. If I am disturbed in this, the consequences will be catastrophic."
Farfel glanced around the room. The only window was too small to permit him to climb out, while the room's only door had Luthius Lynn on the other side of it.
"Unfortunate indeed," he sighed.
Then he took the bag his father had given to him and swept into it all the trinkets, oddments, and gewgaws he could reach, still taking care not to touch the green flute with his bare flesh. They vanished into the bag, which weighed no more and seemed no more full than it had ever done. He stared at the casement in the center of the room, the only way out, and it led to nothing, to the end of everything.
"Enough," came the voice from beyond the door. "My patience is at an end, Balthazar. My cooks shall fry your internal organs tonight."
There came a loud crunching against the door, as if of something hard and heavy being slammed against it. Then there was a scream, and then silence. Luthius Lynn's voice.
"Is he dead?"
Another voice, Farfel thought it sounded like one of his half-brothers, said, "I suspect that the door is magically protected and warded."
"Then,"
boomed Luthius Lynn, decisively,
"we shall go through the wall."
Farfel was unfortunate, but not stupid. He lifted down the black lacquer box from the nail upon which his father had hung it. He heard something scuttle and move inside it. "My father told me not to move the casement," he said to himself. Then he put his shoulder against it and heaved violently, pushing the heavy thing almost half an inch. The darkness that pervaded the casement began to change, and it filled with a pearl-gray light. He hung the box about his neck. "It is good enough," said Farfel the unfortunate, and as something slammed against the wall of the room, he took a strip of cloth and tied the leather bag that contained all the remaining treasures of Balthazar the Canny about his left wrist, and he pushed himself through. And there was light, so bright that he closed his eyes and walked through the casement. Farfel began to fall. He flailed in the air, eyes tightly closed against the blinding light, felt the wind whip past him. Something smacked and engulfed him, water, brackish, warm, and Farfel floundered, too surprised to breathe. He surfaced, his head breaking water, and he gulped air. And then he pushed himself through the water until his hands grasped some kind of plant, and he pulled himself on hands and feet out of the green water and up onto a spongy dry land, trailing and trickling water as he went. "The light," said the man at Denny's. "The light was blinding, and the sun was not yet up, but I obtained these..." He tapped the frame of his sunglasses. "And I stay out of the sunlight, so my skin does not burn too badly." "And now?" I asked. "I sell the carvings," he said, "and I seek another casement." "You want to go back to your own time?" He shook his head.
"It's dead," he said.
and all I knew, and everything like me, it's dead. I will not return to the darkness at the end of time.
What then? He scratched at his neck. Through the opening in his shirt, I could see a small black box hanging about his neck, no bigger than a locket, and inside the box, something moved. A beetle, I thought, but there are big beetles in Florida. They are not uncommon.
I want to go back to the beginning, he said, when it started. I want to stand there in the light of the universe, waking to itself, the dawn of everything. If I am going to be blinded, let it be by that. I want to be there when the suns are aborning. This ancient light is not bright enough for me.
He took the napkin in his hand then, and reached into the leather bag with it. Taking care to touch it only through the cloth, he pulled out a flute-like instrument about a foot long, made of green jade or something similar, and placed it on the table in front of me.
For the food, he said. A thank you.
He got up then and walked away, and I sat and stared at the green flute for so long a time. Eventually, I reached out and felt the coldness of it with my fingertips, and then gently, without daring to blow or to try to make music from the end of time, I touched the mouthpiece to my lips. And weep, like Alexander. The little man hurried into the fountain and ordered a very large whiskey.
Because, he announced to the pub in general, I deserve it.
He looked exhausted, sweaty and rumpled, as if he had not slept in several days. He wore a tie, but it was so loose as to be almost undone. He had graying hair that might once have been ginger.
I'm sure you do, said Brian.
I do, said the man.
He took a sip of the whiskey, as if to find out whether or not he liked it. Then, satisfied, gulped down half the glass. He stood completely still for a moment, like a statue.
Listen, he said. Can you hear it?
What? I said.
A sort of background whispering, white noise that actually becomes whatever song you wish to hear when you sort of half concentrate on it.
I listened. No, I said.
Exactly, said the man, extraordinarily pleased with himself. Isn't it wonderful? Only yesterday, everybody in the fountain was complaining about the whisper music. Professor McIntosh here was grumbling about having Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody stuck in his head and how it was now following him across London. Today it's gone, as if it had never been. None of you can even remember that it existed, and that is all due to me.
I what? Said Professor McIntosh. Something about the Queen? And then, do I know you?
We meet, said the little man, but people forget me, alas. It is because of my job.
He took out his wallet, produced a card, passed it to me.
Obadiah Polkinghorne,
it read, and beneath that, in small letters, Uninventor. If you don't mind my asking, I said, what's an uninventor?
It's somebody who uninvents things, he said.
He raised his glass, which was quite empty.
Excuse me, Sally. I need another very large whiskey.
The rest of the crowd there that evening seemed to have decided that the man was both mad and uninteresting. They had returned to their conversations. I, on the other hand, was caught. So, I said, resigning myself to my conversational fate, have you been an uninventor long?
Since I was fairly young, he said. I started uninventing when I was 18. Have you never wondered why we do not have jet packs?
I had, actually.
Saw a bit on Tomorrow's World about them when I was a lad, said Michael, the landlord. Man went up in one, then he came down. Raymond Burr seemed to think we'd all have them soon enough.
Ah, but we don't, said Obadiah Polkinghorne, because I uninvented them about 20 years ago. I had to. They were driving everybody mad. I mean, they seemed so attractive and so cheap, but you just had to have a few thousand bored teenagers strapping them on, zooming all over the place, hovering outside bedroom windows, crashing into the flying cars.
Hold on, said Sally. There aren't any flying cars.
True, said the little man, but only because I uninvented them.
You wouldn't believe the traffic jams they'd cause. I'd look up, and it was just the bottoms of bloody flying cars from horizon to horizon. Some days I couldn't see the skies at all. People throwing rubbish out of their car windows. They were easy to run, ran off gravitas solar power, obviously, but I didn't realize that they needed to go until I heard a lady talking about them on Radio 4 all, "Why, oh, why didn't we stick with non-flying cars?" She had a point. Something needed to be done. I uninvented them. I made a list of inventions the world would be better off without, and one by one, I uninvented them all. By now, he had started to gather a small audience. I was pleased I had a good seat. It was a lot of work, too, he continued. You see, it's almost impossible not to invent the flying car as soon as you've invented the lumen bubble. So eventually, I had to uninvent them, too. And I miss the individual lumen bubble, a massless portable light source that floated half a meter above your head and went on when you wanted it. Such a wonderful invention. Still, no use crying over unspilt milk, and you can't mend an omelette without unbreaking a few eggs.
You also can't expect us actually to believe any of this, said someone, and I think it was Jocelyn.
Right, said Brian. I mean, next thing, you'll be telling us that you uninvented the spaceship.
But I did, said Obadiah Polkinghorne. He seemed extremely pleased with himself.
Twice! I had to. You see, the moment we whiz off into space and head out to the planets and beyond, we bump into things that spur so many other inventions. The Polaroid instant transporter, that was the worst. And the Mockit telepathic translator, that was the worst as well. But as long as it's nothing worse than a rocket to the moon, I can keep everything under control.
So how exactly do you go about uninventing things? I asked.
It's hard, he admitted. It's all about unpicking probability threads from the fabric of creation, which is a bit like unpicking a needle from a haystack. But they tend to be long and tangled, like spaghetti, so it's rather like having to unpick a strand of spaghetti from a haystack.
Sounds like thirsty work, said Michael,
and I signaled him to pour me another half pint of cider.
Fiddly, said the little man. Yes, but I pride myself on doing good. Each day I wake, and even if I've unhappened something that might have been wonderful, I think, Obadiah Polkinghorne, the world is a happier place because of something that you've uninvented.
He looked into his remaining scotch, swirled the liquid around in his glass.
The trouble is, he said, with the whisper music gone, that's it. I'm done. It's all been uninvented. There are no more horizons left to undiscover, no more mountains left to unclimb.
Nuclear power? Suggested Tweet Peston.
Before my time, said Obadiah. Can't uninvent things invented before I was born. Otherwise I might uninvent something that would have led to my birth, and then where would we be?
Nobody had any suggestions.
Knee-high in jetpacks and flying cars, that's where, he told us. Not to mention Morrison's Martian emolument.
For a moment, he looked quite grim.
Ooh, that stuff was nasty. And a cure for cancer. But frankly, given what it did to the oceans, I'd rather have the cancer. No, I have uninvented everything that was on my list. I shall go home, said Obadiah Polkinghorne bravely, and weep like Alexander. Because there are no more worlds to unconquer. What is there left to uninvent?
There was silence in the fountain. In the silence, Brian's iPhone rang. His ringtone was the Ruttles singing Cheese and Onions.
Yeah, he said. Then I'll call you back.
It is unfortunate that the pulling out of one phone can have such an effect on other people around. Sometimes I think it's because we remember when we could smoke in pubs, and that we pull out our phones together as once we pulled out our cigarette packets.
but probably it's because we're easily bored. Whatever the reason, the phones came out. Crown Baker took a photo of us all, and then Twit picked it. Jocelyn started to read her text messages. Tweet Peston tweeted that he was in the fountain and had met his first uninventor. Professor McIntosh checked the test match scores, told us what they were, and emailed his brother in Inverness to grumble about them. The phones were out, and the conversation was over.
"What's that?"
asked Obadiah Polkinghorne. "It's the iPhone 5, said Ray Arnold, holding his up. "Crown's using the Nexus 10, that's the Android system. Phones, internet, camera, music, but it's the apps. I mean, do you know there are over 1,000 fart sound effect apps on the iPhone alone? Do you want to hear the unofficial Simpsons fart app?"
"No," said Obadiah. "I most definitely do not want to. I do not."
He put down his drink, unfinished, pulled his tie up, did up his coat.
"It's not going to be easy," he said, as if to himself, "but for the good of all."
And then he stopped, and he grinned.
"It's been marvelous talking to you all,"
he announced to nobody in particular, as he left the fountain. Nothing O'Clock. 1. The Time Lords built a prison. They built it in a time and place that are equally as unimaginable to any entity who has never left the solar system in which it was spawned, or who has only experienced the journey into the future 1 second at a time, and that going forward. It was built solely for the kin. It was impregnable, a complex of small, nicely appointed rooms. For they were not monsters, the Time Lords. They could be merciful when it suited them. Out of temporal phase with the rest of the universe. There were, in that place, only those rooms. The gulf between microseconds was one that could not be crossed. In effect, those rooms became a universe in themselves, one that borrowed light and heat and gravity from the rest of creation, or was a fraction of a moment away. The kin prowled its rooms, patient and deathless, and always waiting. It was waiting for a question. It could wait until the end of time, but even then, when time ended, the kin would never perceive it, imprisoned in the micro-moment away from time. The Time Lords maintained the prison with huge engines they built in the hearts of black holes. Unreachable. No one would be able to get to the engines, save the Time Lords themselves. The multiple engines were a failsafe. Nothing could ever go wrong. As long as the Time Lords existed, the kin would be in their prison, and the rest of the universe would be safe. That was how it was, and how it always would be. And if anything went wrong, then the Time Lords would know. Even if, unthinkably, any of the engines failed, then emergency signals would sound on Gallifrey long before the prison of the kin returned to our time and our universe. The Time Lords had planned for everything. They had planned for everything, except the possibility that one day there would be no Time Lords and no Gallifrey, no Time Lords in the universe. Except for one. So when the prison shook and crashed, as if in an earthquake, throwing the kin down, and when the kin looked up from its prison to see the light of galaxies and suns above it, unmediated and unfiltered, and it knew that it had returned to the universe, it knew it would only be a matter of time until the question would be asked once more. And because the kin was careful, it took stock of the universe they found themselves in. It did not think of revenge. That was not in its nature. It wanted what it had always wanted. And besides, there was still a Time Lord in the universe. The kin needed to do something about that. 2. On Wednesday, 11-year-old Polly Browning put her head around her father's office door. "Dad, there's a man at the front door in a rabbit mask who says he wants to buy the house." "Don't be silly, Polly." Mr. Browning was sitting in the corner of the room he liked to call his office, and which the estate agent had optimistically listed as a third bedroom, although it was scarcely big enough for a filing cabinet and a card table, upon which rested a brand-new Amstrad computer. Mr. Browning was carefully entering the numbers from a pile of receipts onto the computer and wincing. Every half an hour, he would save the work he'd done so far, and the computer would make a grinding noise for a few minutes as it saved everything onto a floppy disk. "I'm not being silly. He says he'll give you £750,000 for it."
"Now you're really being silly. It's on sale for £150,000.
And we'd be lucky to get that in today's market," he thought, but did not say. It was the summer of 1984, and Mr. Browning despaired of finding a buyer for the little house at the end of Claversham Row. Polly nodded thoughtfully. "I think you should go and talk to him." Mr. Browning shrugged. He needed to save the work he'd done so far anyway. As the computer made its grumbling sound, Mr. Browning went downstairs. Polly, who had planned to go up to her bedroom to write in her diary, decided to sit on the stairs and find out what was going to happen next. Standing in the front garden was a tall man in a rabbit mask. It was not a particularly convincing mask. It covered his entire face, and two long ears rose above his head. He held a large, leather, brown bag, which reminded Mr. Browning of the doctor's bags of his childhood.
"Now, see here," began
Mr. Browning, but the man in the rabbit mask put a gloved finger to his painted bunny lips, and Mr. Browning fell silent.
"Ask me what time it is," said a quiet voice that came from behind the unmoving muzzle of the rabbit mask. Mr. Browning said, "I understand you're interested in the house."
The for sale sign by the front gate was grimy and streaked by the rain.
"Perhaps. You can call me Mr. Rabbit. Ask me what time it is."
Mr. Browning knew that he ought to call the police, ought to do something to make the man go away. What kind of crazy person wears a rabbit mask anyway?
"Why are you wearing a rabbit mask?"
That was not the correct question. "But I am wearing the rabbit mask because I am representing an extremely famous and important person who values his or her privacy. Ask me what time it is." Mr. Browning sighed.
"Ah, what time is it, Mr. Rabbit?" he asked.
The man in the rabbit mask stood up straighter. His body language was one of joy and delight.
"Time for you to be the richest man on Claversham Row," he said. "I'm buying your house for cash, and for more than 10 times what it's worth, because it's just perfect for me now."
He opened the brown leather bag and produced blocks of money, each block containing 500.
"Count them, go on, count them."
Crisp 50-pound notes and 2 plastic supermarket shopping bags into which he placed the blocks of currency. Mr. Browning inspected the money. It appeared to be real. He hesitated. What did he need to do?
I'll need a few days to bank it, to make sure it's real, and we'll need to draw up contracts, obviously."
"Contracts already drawn up," said the man in the rabbit mask. "Sign here. If the bank says there's anything funny about the money, you can keep it and the house. I'll be back on Saturday to take vacant possession. You can get everything out by then, can't you?"
"I don't know," said Mr. Browning. "Then I'm sure I can. I mean, of course."
"I'll be here on Saturday," said the man in the rabbit mask.
"This is a very unusual way of doing business," said Mr. Browning.
He was standing at his front door holding 2 shopping bags containing £750,000.
"Yes," agreed the man in the rabbit mask. "It is. See you on Saturday, then."
He walked away. Mr. Browning was relieved to see him go. He had been seized by the irrational conviction that were he to remove the rabbit mask, there would be nothing underneath. Polly went upstairs to tell her diary everything she had seen and heard. On Thursday, a tall young man with a tweed jacket and a bow tie knocked on the door. There was nobody at home, and nobody answered, and after walking around the house, he went away. On Saturday, Mr. Browning stood in his empty kitchen. He had banked the money successfully, which had wiped out all his debts. The furniture that they had wanted to keep had been put into a moving van and sent to Mr. Browning's uncle, who had an enormous garage he wasn't using. "What if it's all a joke?" asked Mrs. Browning. "Not sure what's funny about giving someone £750,000, said Mr. Browning. "The bank says it's real, not reported stolen, just a rich and eccentric person who wants to buy our house for a lot more than it's worth." They had booked two rooms in a local hotel, although hotel rooms had proved harder to find than Mr. Browning had expected. Also, he had had to convince Mrs. Browning, who was a nurse, that they could now afford to stay in a hotel. "What happens if he never comes back?" asked Polly. She was sitting on the stairs reading a book. Mr. Browning said, "Now you're being silly." "Don't call your daughter silly," said Mrs. Browning. "She's got a point. You don't have a name or a phone number or anything." This was unfair. The contract was made out, and the buyer's name was clearly written on it. N.M. de Plume. There was an address, too, for a firm of London solicitors, and Mr. Browning had phoned them, and had been told that, yes, this was absolutely legitimate. "He's eccentric," said Mr. Browning. "An eccentric millionaire." "I bet it's him behind that rabbit mask," said Polly. "The eccentric millionaire." The doorbell rang. Mr. Browning went to the front door, his wife and daughter beside him, each of them hoping to meet the new owner of their house. "Hello," said the lady in the cat mask. It was not a very realistic mask. Polly saw her eyes glinting behind it, though. "Are you the new owner?" asked Mrs. Browning. "Either that, or I'm the owner's representative." "Where's your friend? In the rabbit mask?" Despite the cat mask, the young lady, was she young? Her voice sounded young anyway, seemed efficient and almost brusque. "You have removed all your possessions? I'm afraid anything left behind will become the property of the new owner." "We've got everything that matters." "Good." Polly said, "Can I come and play in the garden? There isn't a garden at the hotel." There was a swing on the oak tree in the back garden, and Polly loved to sit on it and read. "Don't be silly, love," said Mr. Browning. "We'll have a new house, and then you'll have a garden with swings. I'll put up new swings for you." The lady in the cat mask crouched down. "I'm Mrs. Cat. Ask me what time it is, Polly." Polly nodded. "What's the time, Mrs. Cat?" "Time for you and your family to leave this place and never look back," said Mrs. Cat, but she said it kindly. Polly waved goodbye to the lady in the cat mask when she got to the end of the garden path. 3. They were in the TARDIS control room, going home. "I still don't understand," Amy was saying. "Why were the skeleton people so angry with you in the first place? I thought they wanted to get free from the rule of the Toad King." "They weren't angry with me about that," said the young man in the tweed jacket and the bow tie. He pushed a hand through his hair. "I think they were quite pleased to be free, actually." He ran his hands across the TARDIS control panel, patting levers, stroking dials. "They were just a bit upset with me because I'd walked off with their squiggly what's it." "Squiggly what's it?" "It's on the..." He gestured vaguely with arms that seemed to be mostly elbows and joints. "The tabley thing over there. I confiscated it." Amy looked irritated. She wasn't irritated, but she sometimes liked to give him the impression she was, just to show him who was boss. "Why don't you ever call things by their proper names? The tabley thing over there. It's called a table." She walked over to the table. The squiggly what's it was glittery and elegant. It was the size and general shape of a bracelet, but it twisted in ways that made it hard for the eye to follow.
Really? Oh, good.
He seemed pleased. I'll remember that. Amy picked up the squiggly Watsit. It was cold and much heavier than it looked.
Why did you confiscate it? And why are you saying confiscate anyway? That's like what teachers do when you bring something you shouldn't to school. My friend Mel set a record at school for the number of things she got confiscated. One night she got me and Rory to make a disturbance while she broke into the teacher's supply cupboard, which was where her stuff was. She had to go over the roof and through the teacher's loo window. But the doctor was not interested in Amy's old school friend's exploits. He never was. He said, confiscated, for their own safety. Technology they shouldn't have had, probably stolen. Time looper and booster could have made a nasty mess of things. He pulled a lever. And we're here. All change. There was a rhythmic grinding sound, as if the engines of the universe itself were protesting. A rush of displaced air, and a large blue police box materialized in the back garden of Amy Pond's house. It was the beginning of the second decade of the 21st century. The doctor opened the TARDIS door. Then he said, "That's odd." He stood in the doorway, made no attempt to walk outside. Amy came over to him. He put out an arm to prevent her from leaving the TARDIS. It was a perfectly sunny day, almost cloudless. "What's wrong?" "Everything," he said. "Can't you feel it?" Amy looked at her garden. It was overgrown and neglected, but then it always had been, as long as she remembered. "No," said Amy. And then she said, "It's quiet. No cars. No birds. Nothing." "No radio waves," said the doctor. "Not even Radio 4.
"You can hear radio waves?"
"Of course not. Nobody can hear radio waves," he said, unconvincingly. And that was when the voice said, "Attention, visitors. You are now entering kin space. This world is the property of the kin. You are trespassing." It was a strange voice, whispery and mostly, Amy suspected, in her head.
"This is Earth," called Amy. "It doesn't belong to you." And then she said, "What have you done with the people?"
"We bought it from them. They died out naturally. Shortly afterwards, it was a pity."
"I don't believe you," shouted Amy.
"No galactic laws were violated. The planet was purchased legally and legitimately. A thorough investigation by the Shadow Proclamation vindicated our ownership in full."
"It's not yours. Where's Rory?"
"Amy, who are you talking to?" asked the doctor.
"The voice, the one in my head. Can you hear it?"
"To whom are you talking?" asked the voice. Amy closed the TARDIS door.
"Why did you do that?" asked the doctor. "Weird whispery voice in my head said they bought the planet and that the Shadow Proclamation said it was all okay. It told me all the people died out naturally. You couldn't hear it. It didn't know you were here." Element of surprise closed the door.
Amy Pond could be astonishingly efficient when she was under stress. Right now, she was under stress, but you wouldn't have known it if it wasn't for the squiggly Watsit, which she was holding between her hands and was bending and twisting into shapes that defied the imagination and seemed to be wandering off into peculiar dimensions.
"Did they say who they were?"
She thought for a moment.
"You are now entering kin space. This world is the property of the kin."
He said,
"Could be anyone. The kin? I mean, it's like calling yourselves the people. It's what pretty much every race name means. Except for Dalek. That means metal-cased Haiti death machines in Skaronian."
And then he was running to the control panel.
"Something like this. It can't occur overnight. People don't just die off. And this is 2010, which means..."
"It means they've done something to Rory."
"It means they've done something to everyone."
He pressed several keys on an ancient typewriter keyboard, and patterns flowed across the screen that hung above the TARDIS console. I couldn't hear them. They couldn't hear me. You could hear both of us.
Ah!
Summer of 1984. That's the divergence point. His hands began turning, twiddling, and pushing levers, pumps, switches, and something small that went ding.
Where's Rory? I want him, right now,
demanded Amy, as the TARDIS lurched away into space and time. The Doctor had only briefly met her fiancé, Rory Williams, once before. She did not think the Doctor understood what she saw in Rory. Some days she was not entirely sure what she saw in Rory, but she was certain of this. Nobody took her fiancé away from her.
Good question. Where's Rory? Also, where's 7 billion other people?
He asked.
I want my Rory.
Well, wherever the rest of them are, he's there too. And you ought to have been with them. At a guess, neither of you were ever born. Amy looked down at herself, checking her feet, her legs, her elbows, her hands. The squiggly Watsit glittered like an Escher nightmare on her wrist. She dropped it onto the control panel. She reached up and grasped a handful of auburn hair.
If I wasn't born, what am I doing here? You're an independent temporal nexus, chronosynclastically established as an inverse...
He saw her expression and stopped.
You're telling me it's timey-wimey, aren't you?
Yes, he said seriously.
I suppose I am. Right, we're here.
He adjusted his bow tie with precise fingers, tipping it to one side rakishly.
But, Doctor, the human race didn't die out in 1984.
New timeline. It's a paradox.
And you're the paradoctor?
Just the Doctor. He adjusted his bow tie to its earlier alignment, stood up a little straighter.
There's something familiar about all this.
What?
Don't know.
Kin.
I keep thinking of masks. Who wears masks?
Bank robbers?
No.
Really ugly people?
No.
Halloween. People wear masks at Halloween.
Yes, they do.
So that's important.
Not even a little bit, but it's true. Right, big divergence in time stream, and it's not actually possible to take over a level 5 planet in a way that would satisfy the Shadow Proclamation unless...
Unless what? The Doctor stopped moving. He bit his lower lip. Then, oh, they wouldn't.
Wouldn't what?
They couldn't. I mean, that would be completely... Amy tossed her hair and did her best to keep her temper. Shouting at the Doctor never worked unless it did.
Completely what?
Completely impossible. You can't take over a level 5 planet unless you do it legitimately. On the TARDIS control panel, something whirled and something else went ding.
We're here. It's the Nexus. Come on.
Let's explore 1984.
You're enjoying this, said Amy.
My whole world has been taken over by a mysterious voice. All the people are extinct. Rory's gone, and you're enjoying this.
No, I'm not,
said the Doctor, trying hard not to show how much he was enjoying it. The Brownings stayed in the hotel while Mr. Browning looked for a new house. The hotel was completely full. Coincidentally, the Brownings learned in conversation with other hotel guests over breakfast they had also sold their houses and flats. None of them seemed particularly forthcoming about who had bought their previous residences.
It's ridiculous, he said after 10 days.
There's nothing for sale in town or anywhere around here. They've all been snapped up.
There must be something, said Mrs. Browning.
Not in this part of the country, said Mr. Browning.
What does the estate agent say?
Not answering the phone, said Mr. Browning.
Well, let's go and talk to her, said Mrs. Browning. You coming with Polly?
Polly shook her head.
I'm reading my book, she said.
Mr. and Mrs. Browning walked into town, and they met the estate agent outside the door of the shop, putting up a notice saying, under new management.
There were no properties for sale in the window, only a lot of houses and flats with sold on them.
Shutting up shop? Asked Mr. Browning.
Someone made me an offer I couldn't refuse, said the estate agent. She was carrying a heavy-looking plastic shopping bag. The Brownings could guess what was in it.
Someone in a rabbit mask? Asked Mrs. Browning.
When they got back to the hotel, the manager was waiting in the lobby for them to tell them they wouldn't be living in the hotel much longer.
It's the new owners, she explained. They are closing the hotel for refurbishing.
New owners? They just bought it. Paid a lot of money for it, I was told. Somehow, this did not surprise the Brownings.